Les colloques du Collège de France.
She's the Walter A. Rosenbliss Professor of Cognitive Neuroscience in the Department of Brain Cognitive Sciences at the MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology. She's an investigator at the McGovern Institute for Brain Research. In 2024, she received the Kavli Prize in Neuroscience together with Winrich Freiwald, and Doris Tsao will speak just afterwards. Because she discovered the fusiform face area, but it's just one of the discoveries that Nancy made. She has discovered and explored many more interesting cortical sites, such as the extrastriate body area, the parahippocampal place area, the TPJ, the temporoparietal junction for social knowledge, or recently a distinction between music and other sounds in human temporal cortex. So she's a true explorer and discoverer. Welcome, Nancy.
Thank you so much. Thanks, Stan, and thanks for all of you for being here. It's just so wonderful to be here with so many of my absolutely favorite colleagues celebrating our friend Stan, who's given us so many thrilling ideas and findings, and I particularly love this list of questions. I think questions are as precious as answers in our field, so that was really nice. So I want to talk today about intuitive physical reasoning in the brain. And this is a line of work that was really originally inspired by, and all of it done with, my dear friend Josh Tenenbaum, who's over here. And most of the work I will talk about today has been done with a wonderful research scientist in my lab, Pramod, shown here, and lots of other people have contributed. So I'm going to jump right in. And by the way, Stan or Vaughn, if you could give me a 3-minute warning, this talk might be too long, and I don't want to miss the last few slides. So what do I mean by intuitive physical reasoning? I think this is easiest to illustrate by just considering what happens when you look at a simple image like this. Within a few hundred milliseconds, you've already realized that there's a fork, there's a glass, there's a table, there's some OJ, there's a placemat. But you've done a lot more than that. You've also realized that the glass is supported by the table, that it contains OJ, that it could be picked up. But it might spill and then might stain the placemat. And so the idea here is that vision is much more than an inventory of the objects that are present and their locations in the world. Vision also includes determining the physical relationships between objects, the action affordances, that is what you can do in this scene, and the possible future states. And this is really the rule, not the exception. So if I show you an image like this, I don't even need to ask you a question. You were already empathizing with this mug and its immediate peril. Even more so, this terrible situation. When you come to a door like this, you just know instinctively not to press there, but to press there. And you know that trouble is about to ensue here. And so the point is that we make intuitive inferences about the physical world frequently, rapidly, apparently effortlessly, and automatically. And this idea goes way, way back and was developed most richly early on by, I don't know where Liz is, she's here someplace, by Liz Spelke's beautiful cognitive development work and René Barjon and a number of other people who pointed out that even very young infants have a lot of these abilities already within just a few months of birth. And so these inferences are critical for understanding what we're looking at, for planning any action in the world. You actually can't make a single motor act without some kind of idea in your head about the world that you're going to be acting on or in, and for predicting what will happen next. So how do we do this? To give a very oversimplified caricature, you can think of the different ideas about how we do this on a spectrum. From the kind of lean, simple view, that it's just pattern recognition. In other words, a lot like what we do in recognizing objects, things that are well modeled by convolutional neural networks, that are just like part of object recognition, part of seeing. And the idea here is that the relevant information could be extracted by simple, probably feed-forward networks, and the representations will be specific and tied to particular perceptual features. So for example, when you saw this, maybe you could realize that there's a situation going on here just by detecting a visual feature of an overhang, and that might be enough to tell you that this is an unstable situation. At the opposite end of the extreme is the idea that our understanding of the physical world is based on a generative model of the world. And this idea I think of as Josh Tenenbaum's. That's in the modern work. It's really it comes from his lab and his students. But versions of this go back to Fergus Craik and before. And the basic idea is that we need a richer, more structured representation of the world that has abstract information about physical properties and the relationships of objects, like, for example, the mass of objects and which objects are in contact with each other. And that these representations will importantly generalize to new scenarios, a key human ability, and that they will enable forward probabilistic simulations of what might happen next. And Josh has called this, as a by analogy to a physics engine in the head, much as exist in video games that enable them to project the images of what's going to happen next in a video game. So, does the brain have a physics engine? Or do we instead use machinery that's more like what we use for object recognition, and maybe the very same pattern recognition systems in the ventral visual pathway? So this is an empirical question. We can make some predictions. If the brain has a physics engine, we can predict that we should find regions that show some kind of selective engagement during intuitive physical inferences, and that those regions should have abstract information about physical properties like object mass. Why mass? Because it's the most basic property of an object that governs how it will behave, you know, F equals MA and all of that, right? We should also find information about object contact because the contact relationships between objects determine the contingencies of their motion. So, for example, when a container moves, anything it contains also moves with it. Okay, we should also predict that the same regions are engaged in simulating what will happen next. And finally, we might also predict that these abilities that we're testing should not be well accomplished by relatively simple artificial neural networks trained on images or videos, like AlexNet and ResNet and all the rest of them. Okay, so there are some predictions. Let's look at this. Starting way back with Jason Fisher and Josh, we set out to ask whether there are brain regions selectively engaged during physical inferences. And this is older work, so I'll just go over it briefly. We found a set of regions in the parietal and frontal cortex that are recruited more when you do a physical reasoning task than a control task on the same stimuli. So we showed subjects these rotating towers that Josh had developed with a lot of beautiful behavioral work before this. And we simply asked people whether if this tower falls, will there be more blocks on the red side or the green side of the platform? And in the control task, we asked whether there are more blue or yellow blocks in the tower, a task that we approximately matched for difficulty. And we found that all of these regions were much more strongly engaged by the tower falling task than the color task. So that, and you can see some of these subregions here all responding more for the tower or physics task than the color task. Then we decided to try something else. We made little animations of moving dots that were either moving in a physical fashion, so bouncing off each other and ricocheting against the walls and behaving like billiard balls, or moving around in a social fashion like the classic Heider and Simmel things where the dots are chasing and flirting and following each other, where you can instantly see in a few second video that this is a social interaction between these two dots. And again, the same regions responded much more strongly for the physically engaged dots than the physically interacting dots than the socially interacting dots. We also showed that the same regions are more strongly engaged when you just passively watch videos of objects interacting, like, for example, this here, just a few seconds of a bunch of objects physically interacting versus a few seconds of a social interaction. And this is data from just a few subjects, but we've seen this in lots of experiments, whopping responses in these same regions during just passive viewing of basically any old video of objects interacting physically. And to me, even more shocking, is exactly zero response. That means the same as staring at a dot and doing nothing. When you look at these rich, engaging social videos that drive lots of other parts of the brain wild. So a big dissociation. As a sidebar, I think, you know, to maybe licensed by Stan's big, huge questions, I would say as a sidebar, I think in some sense, the first principal component of organization of the human brain is between objects and agents, and you can see that here. Okay. Further, we've shown recently that these brain regions are not the same as other regions. You may have seen in some of Stan's data lots of stuff that looks kind of like that. And one thing in particular we wondered about is the regions that have been called multiple demand cortex by John Duncan and his colleagues. These are regions that are in the parietal and frontal lobe that look kind of like that. That are defined by their strong engagement in almost any difficult task compared to an easier version of the same task. So they're called multiple demand because they're engaged by lots of different kinds of cognitive demand. And so we reasoned that if these possible physics regions overlap with the multiple demand regions, they're not really physics regions, and multiple demand isn't really multiple demand, and so we better find out, and we finally did that recently. And to my surprise and delight, actually, if you look at this within individual subjects, which you have to do because if you do group analyses, they blur, actually the overlap is very small, Dice coefficient of 0.07, less than 10% of the voxels in each overlap with the other. So all of this is consistent with the hypothesis we're pursuing, that these regions implement our understanding of the physical world, which is based on a generative model that can run forward simulations to determine what will happen next. AKA a physics engine. But there's much more we need to do. So far, that just shows evidence for the first couple of predictions. Also importantly, these activations are up in the parietal and frontal lobe. They're not in the ventral pathway, famous for pattern recognition. And they're distinct from multiple demand cortex. So in further tests, we have used this tower task to localize those regions in each subject individually so that we can then go back and ask it new questions by precisely targeting the regions that show that signature. And so the next question we asked is whether it contains abstract information about object mass. For my Cogneuro colleagues, this next slide will be totally rudimentary, but to bring everybody along as well as possible, how do you look for information in the brain? In this case, mass information. We use something called multiple voxel pattern analysis, and very simply, what this means is that we collect functional MRI responses across voxels, in this case in our candidate physics network, in two conditions. One, participants are looking at light objects like that, and another, they're looking at heavier objects like that. And so they see lots of different scenarios, lots of different things with a light object and a heavy object. And in each case, we get the pattern of response across voxels in some region for the light objects and another pattern for the heavy objects. And then we do the same thing with a very different scenario. So now the objects are dropped on a pillow. There's a light object. Here's a heavy object. And again, we get the pattern of response in each case. And the key question is whether that pattern of response across voxels is more similar within mass, light to light, or heavy to heavy, than it is between mass, light to heavy, or heavy to light. Sarah Schwettman, who did this work with me and Josh way back, showed that, in fact, that is true in the physics networks. We do find that. And importantly, we find this information about mass just rudimentary, heavy versus light. We're not doing fine-grained decoding. Maybe Stan's fancy machine would be able to do much better. But here, we're just looking at light versus heavy. But importantly, we can do it across objects, across materials, events, scenarios, and even when subjects are not asked about mass. And further, we can do this only in those physics networks, not in the ventral pathway, not in V1, not in other regions. So all that to say, yep, we can decode mass. How about object contact? So Pramod has been working on this for a while and recently published a paper in which he used the same kind of multiple voxel pattern analysis decoding methods based on participants looking at little videos like this depicting the creation of a contact relationship, in this case containment, showing the consequences of contact relationship, contingent motion, other kinds of contact relationships like support and their consequences like that, versus various controls in which there's not contact, in this case occlusion, and the non-conditioned actions effect of that non-contact. And so scanning participants looking at lots of videos like this with many different scenarios and objects and colors and all of that, and cross-decoding across all of those differences, Pramod finds that the physics network can decode the presence versus absence of contact between two objects, and you can't decode that in the ventral pathway or in V1. And in my favorite question, which I think is, in some sense, the crux of the idea of a physics engine, does it do forward simulations? Pramod generated these lovely videos. So the question is, if you see something like this happening, is your brain already extrapolating to see this? And does that happen in the physics network? And so to test that, we made lots of videos like this with different scenarios, different objects, different directions of motion. And we asked, in this case, whether you could cross-decode between the perceived contact versus no contact. There's another case where the thing comes out and misses and doesn't contact. So can you cross-decode between perceived contact versus no contact and predicted contact, no contact? As predicted, if when you see the predicted case, those brain regions are generating that the prediction of what will happen. And indeed, we see that again in the physics network, not in V1 or the ventral pathway. So all of this, and also again across all of these many differences in the scenarios. So these are very abstract representations we're finding here, again consistent with the physics engine idea, not with a pattern recognition system. So that's what I just said. All of this is consistent with this physics engine idea. Now I made one sort of sleight of hand here. I slipped between saying simulation, a kind of step-by-step forward simulation of what will happen next, and prediction, which could be a linear thing. You could just generate a one-step prediction, and we haven't resolved that yet. So the data I just showed could be just a one-step prediction, and we need to do more to test a kind of full-scale simulation. Okay. But now you might wonder, how do we know that these simple convolutional neural networks trained on images or videos can't do these same tasks? So recently, Pramod has been working with a post-bac student, Georgina Wu, and they've been testing all kinds of artificial neural networks that are trained on images or videos on these ginormous video data sets of various sorts. Some of them are trained to do, well, there's to interpret actions or predict what physical objects will be doing. These things are coming along all the time. We tested this VGEPA model, and then like a week later there was VGEPA 2, and yesterday I got an email that there's a really important new one. I haven't even read that paper yet. It's very hard to keep up with this field. The general finding is that performance of these artificial neural networks is jagged, that is uneven across tasks, and it's not very human-like. So they don't fail across the board at all of these kind of intuitive physics tasks, but they're not human-like and not consistent. And so Pramod and Georgina tested a whole suite of these computational models on the same stimuli we had tested with functional MRI. You test them in the same way, you show the network contact versus no contact, you collect its activations, and you do decoding analyses in all the same ways. And the general finding is that these models perform badly and unevenly, and the same deal with the prediction tasks using our stimuli. They also do badly at that. And you might wonder about, okay, what about fancier models? What about vision language models? And so some papers have looked at that. They do a little better, but they're still not very human-like. And you can ask me later how GPT-5 does. It's kind of funny, but I don't want to take the time right now. It doesn't do very well. So far it looks like the standard artificial neural networks just trained, end-to-end on images and videos are not capturing what humans are doing or what the dorsal pathway, what the physics regions are doing. So we need to do more comprehensive tests and try to keep up with this insane literature. So, does the brain have a physics engine? I would give it a resounding maybe. There's lots more we need to do. I'll mention a few ongoing or recent lines of work. One question is, what is the scope of engagement of this thing, right? So, importantly, So far, I've only talked about very simple interactions of rigid objects with each other, but there's much more to the physical world than that. So we might be interested, are these regions also engaged by non-rigid objects? How about auditory physical events? How about language describing physical events? And so, how am I doing? Am I running out of time? No. Okay, I'm going to keep talking until they give me the three-minute warning. So Vivian Paoloon has been working on this question of whether it's only rigid objects. And based on some beautiful early paper by Ted Adelson called On Seeing Stuff, I totally recommend it if you haven't read it. The observation is that, well, here are some things, and here's some stuff. And the underlying physics of things and stuff is just fundamentally different. And because of that, the way we interact with things is fundamentally different from the way we interact with stuff. And so you might think that the brain would treat things and stuff differently. And so Vivian set out to ask that. And she created these just fabulous videos. I'll show you a few here. Here's a thing. And here's a non-rigid thing in the same scenario. I love that one. Here's some granular stuff, and here's some liquid stuff. And Vivian's just a master of making beautiful stimuli. She's made all different versions with different scenarios and colors and textures and all these different kinds of things and stuff, scanned people looking at them and found that the physics regions respond to all of these compared to scrambled controls, but more to things than stuff a bit. And most intriguingly, there seems to be a kind of ventral annex of the physics system that responds more to stuff than things. And these are always, I think, the most fun and empowering findings in cognitive neuroscience when you find a dissociation, because then you can chip away some more. And so that's promising. And Vivian has just started her own faculty position at the University of Wisconsin, and she'll be pursuing that in her own lab. Auditory physical events, we've just started messing around with this, and so far we're not finding strong responses to vivid audio clips of physical events, and I'm not taking no for an answer, so I don't believe that yet. And already we're also seeing that even when we don't get much response to an audio clip of a physical event alone, it does add to produce a higher response to a visual clip of the same thing. So at least there's some kind of super additive interaction where the audio information enriches the visual information about a physical event. So stay tuned on that. What about language? Can we engage these regions through language? And do we when understanding language? And this brings up the broader question, again, feeling licensed by Stan, and actually I planned this before, but now I feel less bad about it. I'm gonna go for like the ludicrously broad question of what does it even mean to understand language in the first place? And so, I and others have been making pictures like this. Most other people's aren't so simple-minded, but I like simple-minded ones, where the brain has all these specialized regions that do different things. And so how do we understand language in here? You know, these classic temporal and frontal regions that have been known for 200 years to process language. And the idea here is that these cortical language regions have been shown by many labs to be well modeled by large language models. That is, you can predict responses in those regions very accurately with large language models. And so in other work, it's pretty clear that large language models, even the very old ones, very old, like 3 years old, that are trained only on text, show a kind of shallow understanding of language, by which I mean they're very good at syntax. And they have aspects of word meaning. You can show in various ways that they, just from the statistics of language that they're trained on, they've actually captured a lot of the meaning of individual words. But they still fail at many human tasks, including aspects of intuitive physics. So the idea I want to put forth is that these core language regions in the human brain are similarly process a kind of shallow language understanding, and that the deeper, richer understanding we achieve from language is based on the fact that we export that information from those language regions to lots of other parts of the brain that can build models of the stuff described in language. And there's at least one case where we know this happens, and that's the work of Rebecca Sachs, showing that the TPJ that's selectively engaged in thinking about other people's thoughts is engaged when you read a couple sentences about what someone else is thinking, or even a couple sentences that you need to infer what someone else is thinking to understand the gist of those sentences. So that's a clear case where the sentences presumably come in through language cortex and then end up in the opposite hemisphere in the right TPJ. How does it know to go there? Good question, don't know. And the proposal I'm putting forth here is that that's just one of a broad case of situations where language information will be exported to these other regions. For example, you know, maybe to these intuitive physics regions. So just a tiny bit of data on that. Again, this is Pramod's work with now my colleague, Laura Schultz. So we've been giving people simple intuitive physics problems through language. So they read things like, the robot vacuum cleaner swept through the house, humming and buzzing. Its green and white lights flashed continually as it moved around the living room, removing dust bunnies. Then it got stuck in the curtain, backed up, and bumped into the side table, which knocked a lamp onto the floor. And then we ask people, what made the table move? The robot vacuum cleaner, the lamp, or both? Okay, so that's just basic intuitive physics tasks coming in through language. And for controls, we use social tasks. For example, walking home from work, a woman turned into a dark alley and saw a group of men loitering on its corner, laughing drunkenly. When she heard footsteps behind her, she accelerated her pace and clutched her purse tightly. From that time on, she took the long way home. The woman took the long way home because alley made her uncomfortable, because she liked walking, or both. Okay, so kind of dopey, simple questions like that. And we're just asking whether those physics regions respond more to the physical scenarios than the social ones, and they do. That is cool. But even cooler is that I mentioned that this work was in collaboration with my colleague Laura Schultz, who was more interested in asking whether these regions are particularly involved in inferring causes, something Laura has worked on for a very long time. And so we also included scenarios that do not describe causal events. They're physical or social, and they're just descriptive. And you're asked about descriptive questions about what you just read. And here we get no difference between those and lower responses overall. So we're doing many follow-up studies of this right now, but I think it's an intriguing possibility that these intuitive physics regions, A, respond to language, and B, seem particularly interested in language about physical stuff, and they're particularly interested in causal structures. Okay, so a few other findings. I said all this. Okay, all of this is consistent with the intuitive physics, the physics engine hypothesis. However, there are loads of unanswered questions that remain. I'll just mention a few. What else is represented in these regions? What about force and momentum and friction and all this other stuff? And what about all the non-physics things we haven't tested? Critically, we need to know about the causal role of these regions in intuitive physical reasoning. We started trying to test some patients, and then with a colleague in the UK, and then NIH told us we will not fund foreign collaborations. God help us in the US, it's a disaster. What is the relationship between these regions and other nearby regions, importantly, including those that process number, that Stan has championed and done all the major work on? To what extent are these regions engaged in uniquely human operations, like novel tool use, which is distinctively or uniquely human, and all of science and engineering? And I've been wondering about this for a while, particularly on analogy to the lovely study that Stan mentioned with Maria Malrich, showing that that professional mathematicians use those same math systems. We've been wondering whether professional physicists use the same system. And do these regions really do simulation rather than just kind of one-step prediction? And how rich is it, and how automatic is it, and all of that? And what computational models capture what goes on here? So anyway, there's lots of questions. And to answer many of these, we just need better access to the neural code. I'm constantly frustrated by the weakness of what we can see with functional MRI. It's great, but it's limited. And we also need to see how those neural codes change over time on a millisecond basis. And that's why in my last 2 minutes, do I have two, 3 minutes? Okay, good, okay. I want to mention a collaboration I just started 2 weeks ago that I'm wildly excited about, and that is with Richard Anderson, the wonderful Richard Anderson, who's been studying the parietal lobes for a very long time and the representation of space and action. And he has been more recently studying human subjects with Utah arrays implanted in posterior parietal cortex. This is in tetraplegic patients who can't move their arms or legs. And so what he's doing is trying to develop brain-machine interfaces that will enable these people to control remote devices. And so these amazing participants have agreed to have Utah arrays chronically implanted. And I had the incredible opportunity to travel around with Richard's postdoc Celia Bugu 2 weeks ago to test one of these participants. And so this guy has four Utah arrays, one in the superior parietal lobe. We don't know that that's going to be on top of the physics network, but it's right in the zone. And so to find out if it is, we ran our standard tower localizer and also those video clips of physical versus social events and our spatial working memory task. And so it's quite amazing. You come into a little mini mall in an anonymous part of the LA basin, and in wheels this wonderful participant who has shoulder movement so he can control his own wheelchair, and he just wheels in, and Celia attaches the cables to his Utah arrays, and boom, there's neurons on the screen. Blows my mind. And so what do we see? In this tower task, we see this is now time. This is averaging high gamma over all 100 electrodes in that entire superior parietal lobule array. We see a higher response when participants are doing the tower falling task than the color task. And here's an example of a single neuron in that array. So yeah, that's pretty cool. It's on top of the physics network. In responding to the video clips, we see even more astonishing response to the physical videos, response to the social videos, not different than staring at a dot. Same deal with individual neurons in that region. And for the multiple demand test we've been using, the difficult versus easy spatial working memory task, none of this reached a statistical significance. There's a little bit of a hint of a higher response to hard than easy, so we'll need to get more data to find out. But I just love how you can see sample one, sample two, sample three, response choice. So cool. Some single neurons, no difference whatsoever. So I know I'm out of time, so I will just stop there and say I think that this is going to enable us. Oh, let's just skip that. There's, yeah, whatever. I think these methods will enable us to dig in much more powerfully to answer some of these questions, and I'm hopeful that Richard will play with us more and let us do that. Thank you.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.